As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to The Game podcast from The Times. I'm Alison Rudd, your host in place of Gab Marcotti, who's on an Italian refresher course. But the good news is that we have three splendid guests in the form of Oliver Kay, James Scowcroft and Julian Laron. Today we'll be talking about FA Cup magic, mystery and mayhem, and we will debate just which Premier League club is facing the biggest crisis. But we start at Deepdale, where Arsenal did that fight back thing again.
Towards Giroud. It's down to Perez with the back heel. And Giroud! And the Frenchman has done it again.
Preston North End outplayed Arsenal, took the lead, should have scored more, but allowed Ramsey to equalise. And then that man, Olivier Giroud, scored his fourth goal in four games to seal the win. I wonder, was this an unacceptable Arsenal performance, given they were outplayed by Bournemouth 4 days earlier? Or should we hail their strength of character? Ollie Kay, you were at Deepdale. Did you leave feeling, wow, I'm seeing a really tough Arsenal who fight back from all sorts of setbacks? Or did you see an Arsenal that you were surprisingly spineless, two halves in two games?
Well, I think you get both with Arsenal. I think if you look at them in recent years, there have been moments where they've often given themselves a lot to do, left themselves needing snookers, whether it's in individual matches or to qualify for the next round of Champions League or to get into the top four of the Premier League. And they just seem to be at their best when the pressure is really on, but not in a way that seems to help them achieve their very biggest goals. It's a bit of a flaw in their makeup that they don't seem very often to just do the business of making winning matches look easy. It's a good start and then they tail off like they did at Everton and Man City, or it's a disastrous start and then a miraculous fight back. And it's not just the last two games, Bournemouth and Preston, but the Ludogorets and Swansea and Southampton and other teams, Burnley in the season. It's so many last minute goals. Everything seems so last ditch with Arsenal, whether it's goals at one end or the other. It's probably slightly worrying and not especially nerve-wracking for their fans.
Julian, I mean, you see a lot of Arsenal. I mean, do you agree with Ollie that a club can have this inherent characteristic? That, I mean, Ollie seems to be implying this is who Arsenal are now. They have to put their fans through the mill this way.
Yeah, I think they have games where they don't really fancy it and they don't really start the way they should, and I think I don't think it's complacency. I think it is a bit of choosing their games at times, and I think the Bournemouth game certainly felt like this. I thought on Saturday it felt like that as well, and you could tell. I don't know. I thought even at warm up, I could see like, well, it's going to be a tough start because they were not. Even at warm up, you could tell they were not that ready.
What about the warm up? What?
I think it lacks intensity at times, and you see, I was at the West Brom game and I thought exactly the same, and I thought they started slowly again, and I do think that when they start slowly and when they it's either from the start, like against the Chelsea game for example, they won 3, it's either from the start they're there straight away, they put pressure, their passing is good, it's all slick, there's a lot of movement, and then it would be like that for most of the game. Or if they start slowly, they start losing the balls, poor passing, it's all a bit slow. The other team, in fairness, like Preston, put a lot of aggression. They're aggressive more than Arsenal, and you could see it happening. And then you know that they're going to have a poor first half, and then it will take far more from them in the second half to come back. And Bournemouth was exactly like that as well.
James, do you agree, first of all? And is this why Arsenal just aren't going to win the league? Because you can't afford to be that flaky too often.
No, you can't afford to be that flaky as well, because you know, coming from behind, you're not going to do it every week. There's going to be times where you're going to come unstuck. I actually think, you know, I was at Millwall Bournemouth at the weekend, and I saw a Bournemouth side just totally underestimate Millwall. And I think there's a lot of Premier League clubs now. Nobody takes it seriously, so you can't expect the players to go out full of tempo, full of enthusiasm, on the front foot from the start. And, you know, they've probably got away with it, really. And I think as a lot of these clubs, Arsenal being the last thing you would have wanted is a replay. You know, and if you look over the years, you know, they have come and stuck a little bit. I can remember an Arsenal side a few years ago drawing with Leighton Orient and getting a replay back at the Emirates, and there's been other games as well. So I just think it's a trend coming. It's great coming back and scoring last minute winners. There's no better feeling, but there's only so many times you can do that.
Ollie, I mean, the good news for Arsenal is that Giroud almost looks like a new signing. He was captain at Deepdale. Are you a fan?
I am a fan. I'm not a worshipper or anything like that. The strange thing about Giroud, you look at the type of player he is, a target man centre forward who scores goals when the ball is put in the right places for him. And you would think he would be a really sort of steady goal scorer, sort of steady 25 goal a season man, because he's not outstanding, he's not sensational, but he's very competent. He's all round game, but he does seem to be one of these real confidence players, which is rare for a striker of that type, I would say. Maybe James would disagree, but you would expect him to be a much steadier player rather than the player he is, which is blowing hot and cold a lot of the time. And you know, when he's hot and when he's scoring goals, he looks really good, as he did. I thought he's one of the better players in the first half on Saturday, and obviously came up with a big moment again in the second.
Has Giroud turned a corner, James, do you think?
I think he has, yeah, definitely. I think if you look at him now, he's a pivotal part of Arsenal's squad, isn't he? Where would they be without him? Yeah. And he obviously is a confidence player. And what I would say, Ollie, is a lot of centre-forwards are confidence players. Yeah. You get judged on goals, and I always sort of you're either the hero or the villain. If you're scoring, you're the hero. If you're not, people are, you know, why is he playing? You know, get him out. And I think that happens to every centre-forward. Goals don't really come in one every other game or one in three. Mm. They come in sort of streaks, really. So it's part, I think, probably he's become mentally stronger to deal with. If he doesn't score or hasn't played a good game, he can go into the next game focused. And that's the key to consistency, really.
Julian, go on, give us the insight, the French insight. What makes him tick?
No, I think he had a really tough start of the season because he was not playing, he was a bit injured, and Alexis Sanchez were doing so well in that centre-forward position that there was no room for him. But I think he never gave up, and he's someone who's had to never give up, because it was never easy for him. He never really went, he didn't follow the normal path of you go to an academy, you make your debut at 18 or 19, and then you play in the first team, and then you become so good that you move to a bigger club, and then you know, it was never like that for him. He had to play in lower leagues, he had to struggle, and then finally, in a really later stage of his career, things finally happened for him, and that's where he is now. And I think that's why he's so strong. I think he's going to sign a new contract for the club, which he deserves. I really believe he deserves, because whether you think Alexis Sanchez is a better striker, I've got no issue with that. But I think you do need an Olivier Giroud in your team, whether you're Arsenal or anyone else, because he brings you something different. You know, I don't think without him they would have come back the way they did against Bournemouth. Without him they wouldn't have scored that goal he did against West Brom, for example, a late header like that when it's hard to score. And same on Saturday. And I think
he scored loads of key goals. The equaliser, yeah, at Old Trafford.
But again, if you play on his strength, it's always the same. If you expect him to play like Alexis does, or like, I don't know, Luis Suarez does, it's not going to work. If you play on his strength and you pull, you know, you put good crosses in like Old Trafford, where his linker play can be useful to your team and you benefit from it, like he did at Bournemouth, like he did against Preston on that second goal, which is, you know, it's sort of a very good move with him involved from start and then with the finish, or that backheel volley or whatever against Palace as well, where he's there from the start and he helps the team going forward. Then if you play on his strength, I think he's a really good asset to have in your squad, whether he's a starter or not. He's a very good asset to have. But if you play not on his strength, then he can look like he's a passenger in a performance.
But to be fair, Julian, Arsene Wenger's always coached and taught his wide players to come inside, haven't they? That's no good. If you're a centre forward and a wide player gets a ball, you want him to deliver the ball. You know, wherever it is, just put it in an area so you can try and attack the ball. But if you're coming inside and it's an extra pass, you eventually get caught on your heels.
That's why I think he's doing very well, considering the style of football that Arsenal are playing.
How did the scorpion kick go down in France?
Oh, great, yeah. It was fantastic. But I think he was what I liked the most about it is afterwards he said, listen, it's all down to luck. It's nothing. I don't try out training. It was just there. I tried it. It went in. And I like the fact that he was humble like that.
I listened to the first half on the radio and the only name I heard over and over again was Aidan McGeady's name. Then I watched it later and I thought, is this a player who is caught because he's too good for the Championship but not good enough for the Premier League?
I've seen Aidan McGeady quite a bit during his career. Obviously, he's at Celtic and then he went to Russia and Everton. And I've always thought, watching mostly in highlights, I always think he's a fantastically gifted player. And one of these, you know, Celtic always also had Sean Maloney, similar, Paddy McCourt, some of these sort of really sort of enigmatic flair players who would play wide and just dance through defenders. He's one of those, and he's brilliant on his day, and he was brilliant on the first half on Saturday. He just seems to be a player who, from what I've heard about him in his career, and probably the other two as well, that it's not a case of not being good enough for that level. It's more a case of probably not being consistent enough to do it every week. He's probably a guy who has, you know, in four games he'll probably have one exceptional one good one mediocre one and one terrible one, and I don't think teams at the top level probably want that level of inconsistency. But he's a really, really talented player, and he gave the poor young Arsenal fullback a real runaround in the first half.
Ollie, do you think his move to Spartak Moscow held him back a little bit? Probably wasn't. I'm sure financially it was beneficial for him. But, you know, look at it now. He was 24 when he went to Spartak. He was there for 4 years, really. So it's a big part of your career, 24 to 28, to go off the radar as such, really, where you need to be playing week in, week out, and just becoming a better player by experience.
No, I'm told he did all right over there, but he was desperate to come back to Britain when the opportunity came.
A West Brom or somewhere where you know, where he could have got regular football, I'm sure he would have been better. Because if you look at it, he's played 86 times for Ireland. You know, that's.
Well, he played in the Champions League and stuff like that. You know, he was playing at a good level, but. You know, would he prefer? I mean, it's probably not the Oscar conversation we had on here a few weeks ago about him going to China at 25 or whatever age he is, and to lose that sort of big main chunk of your career, the peak years of your career, to go to Russia. And I'm not saying it's a bad league, but it's off the radar, as you say, in terms of, you know, his homeland. It's difficult. It doesn't seem to have done wonders for his long-term development, but he will always be that kind of player who will be able to do it on his day.
Is he in the right place now, though?
It looked like it. I mean, he looks like he's, you know, sort of bigger fish in a small pond. I mean, that Preston team worked incredibly, incredibly hard on Saturday, and he was probably the one sort of luxury player in the team that. If that's how they play every week, then that's definitely a great team for him to be in, because he's got so much freedom to do his thing. But it's I know Preston are a decent Championship team, but I think they played well above themselves in that first half on Saturday, and credit to them for doing that. But I was just slightly mystified that all Arsenal's players were saying they were surprised by it, because what do you expect?
We're not going to cover every single other game, but three that are worth discussing are Spurs, who took on Aston Villa, Liverpool took on Plymouth, and Millwall faced Bournemouth. There were 9 changes for Spurs, 10 changes for Liverpool, and 11 changes for Bournemouth, which I think probably gives us some sort of mathematical conundrum. Spurs managed to win by making changes within changes. Liverpool made too many changes and could not break through, and Bournemouth completely collapsed. The bit about changes I think is interesting is that Jurgen Klopp talked a better game than Eddie Howe when it came to explaining the changes, because Eddie Howe, as far as I could see, didn't even seem to get that if you make 11 changes, that means a brand new team, and they've got to have played together. They've got to know each other. Whereas Klopp got it and said, look, these guys have played together. Yes, I'm making 10 changes, but these guys know each other and they are a team and they're worth persevering with. James, do you see my point? I mean, it seemed to me Eddie Howe just took a punt, took a risk and hadn't thought it through.
Well, only Eddie Howe knows the answer to that. I was actually at the game and they were so far off the pace, Bournemouth. You could, you know, Neil Harris said afterwards, Millwall could have won by more, and they could have done. They were. It makes a massive difference. All these players that are playing reserve under 23 football, however you want to label it, it is nowhere near the match tempo, the speed, the preparation, the mental focus to first team football. And for example, the Millwall players were just so much quicker, sharper to the ball, hungrier. And they just never got going, the Bournemouth players. And, you know, but Bournemouth, well, they only made 11. I think the team cost a total of 44 million. So it's not, this wasn't a load of young kids. This was good players that, you know, some of them have got good reputations as well. So I can see Jurgen Klopp's point. He's playing a team that does play regular together. And if you match the sides up, probably the under 23 level is the same as League Two. So, you know, is it a shock? Is it a giant killing? You know, probably not. But I think Eddie Howe, especially from Bournemouth, a lot of people have laughed at Paul Merson this week for his predictions, but he actually made a good point saying Bournemouth aren't going to go down, they're not going to finish in the top six. Why on earth have they not taken this competition seriously? It's staggering. They haven't got a fixture pile up, they haven't, you know, they're in a reasonable run of form. Crystal Palace, who I think they've got a better squad than Crystal Palace last season, got within 12 minutes of winning the competition last year. Why? You know, why didn't he take
it
seriously?
Well, maybe they don't take it seriously, Ollie, because Alan Pardew got to the FA Cup final last season and he still gets sacked when things go slightly wrong for them at club at Premier League level. So maybe the risk reward isn't there for them.
Yeah, I know what you mean, but it's you know, he didn't get sacked because he got to the cup final. In fact, probably getting to the cup final saved him. Yeah. Yeah, I think if you look at the results of the second half of last season, I think the cup run was all that saved them. Now, it might have had an adverse effect in some way on their league form, and maybe you could argue the other thing. But I totally agree with James, what he's saying about, you know, mid-table teams. I mean, if you look at the teams at the top six, is the FA Cup their priority? No. Is it their number two priority? Well, probably not really, because most of them are in you know, other cups and Europe and Liverpool in the League Cup, Man United in the League Cup, etc. The bottom six or seven, is it their priority? No, but it's probably, you know, it's a bonus. But those mid-table teams who aren't going to get into top six, particularly this season because the gap's so big, they're not going to go down. And yet you look at it, you know, this morning, Everton out, Stoke out, West Brom out, Bournemouth out, West Ham out. And Burnley out? Did Burnley go out? Yeah, I mean, if they did, it's for the win, but I didn't notice. It's those are the teams who should be thinking, right, we can actually enjoy ourselves, have a cup run. And I know Bournemouth and I know Burnley haven't got great squads like the top, you know, the top four, five, six teams do. But they don't need to be playing 50 games, 60 games. They need to be playing 38 to probably 45 games. You know,
Ollie, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Do you think the League Cup has slightly overtaken the FA Cup?
I do. If you look at Man United and Liverpool, they're both through, obviously, and Southampton are and Hull, and it probably takes away from the FA Cup slightly when, you know, I think the timing of the League Cup helps the League Cup in that it's all done and dusted by February. But the timing of the FA Cup is terrible because you go through that period of what was it, sort of five games in a fortnight over Christmas, and then the FA Cup right at the end of that, and it's when everybody does genuinely need a rest. Now, if the FA are thinking, what can we do to make the FA Cup, you know, better and more prioritised by the clubs, I think changing the calendar in some way, whether it's with a winter break or not, I think if it wasn't just this sort of additional game at the end of this grueling run, I think teams would take it seriously. I know people say, oh, but it has to be the first weekend of January. Well, no, it doesn't. I remember 10 years ago or 15 years ago, whenever it was, they played the third game, the third round in December. And
I can remember playing it myself then.
Was it because... No,
it wasn't to do with the United thing, was it?
I think it was, which is why that I then can't work out how it could have been, because United pulled out, so why would they have moved it to accommodate United, who they didn't accommodate?
Because they went in January, didn't they, to the World Championships.
It was 99-2000.
Yeah, no, I remember playing for Ipswich against Southampton in December, and it was the middle of December as well. I don't think it was late. Mm.
Julian, did Liverpool were at home, did meddling with the team, did making wholesale changes backfire more for Jurgen Klopp than it did for Eddie Howe in the end? Because Liverpool were at home, and now they've got to travel a long, long way.
A long way for a replay that they probably could do without. I don't think you can blame Klopp for trying, for doing that as well, because they're second in the league. It's a tough time, like Ollie said, and I agree with both boys that the timing is wrong, and I don't think you can blame those managers for making those changes. Eddie Howe said, I made a mistake, I thought this team was good enough to win at Millwall, it wasn't, it's my fault, I take it. And I can see also James Bond on, like, those 11 players for Bournemouth, you know, never played with each other before. Liverpool, it was a bit different, although they surely didn't play that much at that level, at least, with, you know, all the pressure and expectations and everything. I think the other point is, League One is a tough league. Like you said, James, Millwall were more hungry, they wanted it more, they were more aggressive, because that's how they play every week. Every game is like that in League One. And I think if the Premier League club, who then go to a League One club, or even a Championship club, and they're not really ready for that, because that's not really, you know, Premier League is intense, but it's not a dog league. It's not like, you're not, you know, but do you see what I mean? And if you then go to Millwall and you're not ready to win the first ball or the second or even the third or fourth, because often against League One team, even Championship teams, it goes down to the fourth ball, not just the second ball, then you get, they walk on you. And if they start walking on you, their confidence goes high, yours goes down, your head drops, not theirs.
Yeah, you're spot on. The Bournemouth philosophy, the style of play, just might suit the Premier League. It just did not suit League One, because every time they got a goal kick, the goalkeeper got it, the two centre-half split, sort of, you know, almost level with him, full-backs. They tried to play out from the back, and every single time Millwall onto it, they wonder. But they could have been 2-0 up in the first 15 minutes by winning the ball high up, by pressurising and winning second balls. And Bournemouth just couldn't adapt. They couldn't change the way they played. They couldn't all of a sudden, look, we're going to have to roll our sleeves up here and match them and then try and play our football. And they couldn't do it.
And Arsenal were the same. I know Ollie was really surprised to hear the players saying that, but they were not ready for that either. And I think if they don't score so early in the second half, Arsenal, they never come back, full stop, because they were just not ready for that kind of aggression that lower league teams sometimes offer, because they're so used to it in there.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Own leagues.
There was a script that was more likely, I suppose, at Spurs, in that Pochettino made 9 changes Vincent Janssen didn't work out. He goes off on the hour mark and Dele Alli comes on. It's as if someone is actually writing this. Dele Alli changes the game. I mean, this is sort of heroic stuff. He's having an amazing couple of weeks, isn't he, Dele Alli, Ollie? I mean, is this going to carry on all season? Is he so integral to Spurs and then winning silverware at last?
Certainly, you know, an outstanding player for them. But you know, is he any more important than Kane has been over the last few seasons, or Eriksen, or Alderweireld, or Lloris? I mean, he's just another really good player that they've got, and you know, you can't, if you're playing lining up against Tottenham, I don't think you'd sort of plan purely to stop Dele Alli. I don't think stopping Dele Alli means you stop Spurs. But he's just a really good player in a rich vein of form, and it's great to see as a young Englishman, but I'm not a young Englishman. He's a young Englishman, and it's great to see.
James, he's been linked to Spain. He's been linked to Barca and Real Madrid. Like they're going to fight for him or something. Do you see that as realistic?
Certainly, is realistic, isn't it? You know, why wouldn't he be linked? I think if you're a big club like Real Madrid. Even so, Real Madrid more than Barcelona, really. I think he suits Real Madrid a bit more. If you look at the best young players in Europe, he has to be in the top five at the moment. Spurs notoriously, I can't see how they're going to keep hold of him unless they can sort of break getting into the Champions League every year. You know, they eventually need to win the league or you know, really start competing, which they are, to be fair. You know, the football's a short career. He's only really going to get 10, 12 years at the very, very peak if he's lucky. So the kid himself will think, you know, at some stage, I want to go and play with the very, very best in the world. So, unfortunately, I can see it happening.
If you were his advisor, what would you say? Surely it's better for him to stay with a coach who really seems to understand him well. And
what, not go and play in Champions League finals?
But he's still young. He doesn't need to go now.
You can't. Football doesn't last forever, Alison. It's a very, very, very short career. And you can't. There's a lot of people that say, oh, I'm not ready. I'll wait and I'll wait and I'll wait. And I think he should. I think it is too early for him now. You know, he's still very, very young. But I think when he finishes football, he has to look back thinking, no regrets. And, you know, I'm sure Gareth Bale doesn't regret leaving Tottenham to go to Real Madrid at all. You have to try and get to the very, very top. That's a challenge. And you know, you have to say Real Madrid will always be an appeal for him.
Julian, what's the point of Vincent Janssen?
I'm not really sure. I mean,
try.
Yeah,
go on.
I'll try. First, I was watching the Monaco Spurs game, a game that they couldn't lose in the Champions League. To still hoping to qualify. Vincent Janssen came on, and they're putting a bit of pressure towards the end. Although Monaco were always the best side, but there's that moment where he gets the ball and he's back to the Monaco goal, which is perfect because that's what he's really good at. The only thing we've seen him being good at is holding the ball up and then having the whole team, you know, waiting for the whole team then to go up. That's what he's good at. His play back to goal, his linker play that he's good at because he's so strong. So he gets the ball, he puts it down, he holds it up, and then you think, okay, he's going to hold it up and then gives it to Ali or gives it to Ken or Eriksen, and then everybody's going to move up and maybe they're going to create something. There's maybe just 10 minutes to go. He turns round and tries a half volley from 35 yards. The ball goes in row Z or something at the Stade Louis that was not empty, but you know, as we know, not many people there. And I'm thinking like, so I don't even question just the ability. I question his intelligence as well on the pitch. Why would you do that at that moment where you know how important this game is and you're 2-1 down and there's only 10 minutes to go or something? So I just wonder if he gets it. And I thought on Sunday against Villa, I had the same feeling that he didn't get it. He didn't know where to be. He didn't know what to do. He was not, apart from, again, that Lincoln play that he's quite good at. The rest, he had no clue, I thought. And unless Pochettino can make him cleverer in his movement and his decision making and on the ball and off the ball as well, I think he will always struggle in this league. And it's good enough for the Dutch league where James Cockcroft would have scored 50 goals in a season, but in a league like this, I don't know, I don't think he gets it. That's the thing.
Ollie, is this a rare mistake by Pochettino? Did he just buy the wrong player?
I think he wanted to buy somebody who fitted a certain profile where he could play up with Kane where necessary and understudy Kane. I think that's probably quite it's probably not easy to buy somebody for that sort of quite that
that role or those two roles that ticks those boxes. I think when I saw him at the start of the season, I thought, you know, he's got, you know, his feet are good. He's reasonably good technically. He's quick enough. He looks, you know, physically good. He looked intelligent. And I just think looking at him as the season has gone on, I think he looks lower and lower in confidence. We talked about Giroud and his confidence earlier. Janssen looks to me like a guy who is feeling the weight of that, you know, that transfer fee, £70 million. And he's also a guy he came from nowhere almost, you know, to Alkmaar last season. He'd been at Almere, is it? Oh, I don't know how you say it. Almere in Holland, just outside of Amsterdam. And he went to AZ Alkmaar, was a sort of sensation. And now he's stepped up again. And it's probably, I don't know, it's probably come all a bit too quickly for him. And I do have some sympathy with him, because I think there is a decent player there waiting to get out.
What you're saying, Ollie, is that Vincent Janssen is the painting in Oliver Giroud's attic.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. That's beautiful. Finally on this, James, do you think Villa looked like they're capable of becoming a great club again?
Not on yesterday's show, no. I think it's going to be a long path back for Aston Villa. I think they might even struggle to get out of the Championship this year, and it'll get harder and harder for them.
And so to our debate. Three clubs have pressed the panic button. Hull have appointed Marco Silva, Swansea have turned to Paul Clement, and Palace started it all off by turning to Sam Allardyce. Hull prop up the table, but they are in the semi-final of the EFL Cup, and they beat Swansea in the FA Cup. So are they really the club most deeply mired in trouble? Ollie, you addressed Hull's woes in your column. Could you sum up for us what's going on up East Riding Way and why fewer than 7,000 were there for Hull's third round tie?
Yeah, well, if you look across the board, there were some poor crowds on Saturday in the FA Cup, you know, Bolton and Watford and elsewhere, but the Sunderland. The situation at Hull, there was a boycott against the owners, the Alam family, who have just, I mean, I thought they came in a few years ago and seemed to be doing all the right things, and you know, the big local link between Dr. Alam and the city where he studied at the university, done lots of good things locally, and got them promoted, and then there's this sort of ludicrous, tacky sort of thing where he wanted to rebrand the club Hull Tigers, which he said was all about commercial, you know, commercial attraction and power in Asia, but which also just happened to be at a time when he was in dispute with Hull City Council over the revenue streams at the stadium, It seemed to be more a sort of petty grudge type of thing where he wanted to change the club's name, and not just the idea of that, but more the way the club went about, the owners went about it. That's what really upset Hull's fans, and he's, you know, there was resistance, and he was very rude and I thought unpleasant and condescending about the protests, which I thought the protests were entirely valid. And then since then, there's just, you know, the relationship between owners and fans has just got worse and worse. And, you know, the changes to ticketing strategy where there's no concessions, it's all adult prices and that kind of thing. And that, you know, in an area like Hull where you know, which is, it's got the UK City of Culture thing there, but, you know, it's not a city which thrives financially. A lot of people struggle to afford to get to games, and it's, the way the owners have pushed the fans away is so terribly misjudged, and I actually like to see fans voting with their feet when times are tough, and I was fully in favour of that boycott on Saturday. It's good to see so many empty seats, which might sound perverse.
But so okay, we've got a club where there is a split between the board and the fans, James. I mean, That's one problem, but the separate problem is they just don't have enough. There seems to be transfer nothingness going on. There's a vacuum going on. They never bought enough players when they were promoted, and they're struggling. And yet, this could be an amazing season. They could escape relegation. They could win a trophy.
They could do, but doing and saying and doing are two different things. I thought Steve Bruce left for a reason in the summer, didn't he? I think he knew what was coming and saw the bigger picture. I think Mike Phelan did a decent job, to be fair to him, and I think you could just see his body language in his last few weeks. He'd almost resigned himself. It looks like the owners now have given up. They're not investing in the club at all. The squad they've got is not good enough for numerous reasons. I don't think it's enough depth they've got, really. They rely on too many sort of key players, really. So unless there's an influx of players coming in January, which I just cannot see at all, the writing's on the wall, whoever you have as manager.
So do you agree, Julian, are Hull the club in most crisis in the Premier League?
Maybe. And despite everything we've said, I actually like the fact that they went for Marco Silva. I was expecting, again, because you're so good at it in England, of like, I don't know, having Alan Pardew, a Hurl, or that, how do you say, merry-go-round of managers, yeah, yeah, where you appoint someone who's just been sacked.
What's the French for merry-go-round?
Well, we don't have it, because maybe we
don't have merry-go-rounds in France.
I don't know what we'd say, like, deeply manage depressing or something.
Do you have candy floss?
We have.
But you have big dippers.
Candy floss is Barba Papa, which is amazing.
Ooh, that's
which
nice.
Is like daddy's beard. But no, but you know what I mean? Every time you like the contenders for a job, like the one I heard, are always the same, and the odds are always the same. And Pardew is there, and Roy Hodgson is there, or whoever, and Ryan Giggs' name is always there. And I like the fact that they thought a bit out of the box. It might not work. It might work as well. It might not work, but Marco Silva is a really good manager. He did a great job. You know, at Sporting and at Olympiacos, and I know he's got no experience of the Premier League, but we also have to stop with, you know, he's got no experience of the Premier League, he's going to be a failure. Arsene Wenger had no knowledge of the Premier League, and I know it was a different era, but still he did very well, and Jose Mourinho had no experience of the Premier League either when he first arrived. So I like the fact that yes, they have loads of problems and loads of issues and whatever, but at least I like the guy they picked.
How would Silva keep them up? What would he? How would he do?
I think
how
he's going to tactically.
Somebody else can't. I'm intrigued to know.
No. I think tactically he's a very good manager in terms of experience.
And English managers aren't.
No. Well, I think tactically there's a lot of issues with English managers and the formation of English coaches in England tactically. And I think someone, for example, who's managing Champions League, that's a valuable experience.
What, in a relegation battle?
Yeah, but well, you've already had to be in a relegation battle in England.
There's many different qualities to being a manager. Tactically astute is certainly one of them. Man management skills is probably the biggest corner of being a manager, and it goes on. Knowing players to recruit, is high, certainly high on. So if you're Hull, basically you've got to look at an 18-month plan that there is 70-30 chance on that you're going to get relegated. Yeah. You're going to go into the Championship, and you need stability. You somehow need to sort of keep everyone together to try and build. Because if not, you'll just fall like a stone. Because what will happen is another manager will move on. They'll appoint somebody else who doesn't know the Championship, similar to the Aston Villa scenario. So in a year's time, you'll be in the bottom half of the Championship, and you'll be in a muddle. You'll think. We've got big problems here.
I can give you as many examples of the. Did Aito Karanka knew the Championship? No. Did he go up? Yes. So we're like, why would Marco Silva not do a good job?
He had a stable club that financially was in a very, very good position.
I don't understand this culture that a lot of people in England have of.
You can't say it's over.
No, but it's
overstocked with English managers.
But that's not the point. It's like because he's not English.
I cannot see another English manager getting a top four, top six club. I think that's not the point.
We're talking about Hull and Marco Silva. We're not talking about top four, top six Premier League clubs. Why would Marco Silva be already judged as a failure when the guy just arrived? Because he's not English, because he's never managed in the Championship or the Premier League before, because he's never been in a relegation battle with an English club. Why would that make him the wrong choice or a failure already?
Well, it makes him a risk, doesn't it? It's a risk. If you don't have knowledge of what you're trying to do, it's a risk. If you have no experience of that particular fight, it's a risk.
One thing that he was asked about on Friday, I went to the press conference. He's asked, you know, you've got rid of the British coaching staff there, and are you going to get somebody else in? Wouldn't it be a mistake not to? And he said, yeah, I hope to get somebody in next week. But I do think there's, you know, sometimes when a foreign manager comes in, and Ancelotti always does it, he always has an English assistant alongside him, and you know, Mourinho's done it at times, but not at United. But it's always, I think, helps if there's somebody around on that coaching staff who could say, look, you might not know this about Swansea, or whoever, or Crystal Palace, or whoever to play. I think it is much more of a risk. Probably the potential upside is higher than if you get a party, potentially, if he gets it right. But I think there's probably a greater risk that it goes wrong if you get a Marco Silva, or, you know, we can talk about Pochettino being an example of where it went really right when Southampton did that. It wasn't a popular appointment at the time. But Southampton's board, at least, was known as having good football knowledge. And the Hull City board isn't known for having good football knowledge. So they're reliant on somebody like George Mendes pushing his clients. George Mendes seems to be the one who gains out of this, because to me, it's a risk, not just as far as Hull are concerned, but as far as Silva's concerned. Because he's meant to be one of the best young coaches in Europe, and he's being pushed into a situation which probably doesn't really suit him. He wanted to work in the Premier League, but you can look back at people like Remy Gard and Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, who were hyped as really good young managers across Europe, who get one Premier League job, struggle, go down, and are never heard of again, almost.
Ollie, if you were a manager and you got a job in Spain, would you sack the whole of the Spanish coaching staff that you have at the club and appoint everyone who's English?
No, it would be a big mistake. Big mistake.
But then Paul Clement didn't keep Alan Curtis, so it's just...
Paul Clement is not clearly trying to remind people that he's not foreign.
I think it's easy for us to say, here, oh, he should have kept, but you know, there's different feelings for them arriving. Maybe the English guys on that staff at Hull didn't want him as a manager and didn't want to stay either. I think there's a lot of things. We don't know why is Curtis not staying at Swansea and Paul Clement offering him a job as, like, you look after the loanies, which is the weirdest job title I've ever heard of. So I think, you know, it's different. I would have been certain that Paul Clement would have kept Curtis at Swansea on the staff, and I would say that it's a mistake for not having kept him. But I don't know, maybe they see things differently. I don't know.
Finally, round the table then. Do you all see Hull finishing bottom? Julian, you sound like you might not necessarily. Who's going to finish below Hull?
I just said Marco Silva needs a fair... I think he needs a fair chance, like a fair go at it. That's all. Before we all judge and saying, "Oh, he's not good enough," or "Oh, is this or is that?" Let's just see what he does.
I'm blaming him. Good luck to the chap. I think Hull were in this before the season started. I think if you look at clubs, Swansea certainly didn't expect to be here. Sunderland hoped they wouldn't. Palace certainly didn't expect to be to where they are. So if you look at probably those three clubs are in a bigger crisis than what Hull are. I think Hull are. It's almost got one foot in the championship.
Who will finish below Hull at the end of the season, James?
The team that finished top of the championship.
Okay, Ollie, who will finish below Hull? Anyone?
I would say Hull would be the favourite to finish 20th, if I can put it that way. But to me, it looks like an upgrade replacing Phelan with Silva. But it's a risk. And I also repeat, it's a big risk for him because of his career. I just think that looked like a disinterested but desperate board being advised by an agent to take a certain, you know, a certain coach who's clearly a really good coach, but this might not be the ideal challenge for him. So he's not going to have much money to spend in the transfer window. He's already got a fight to keep hold of Snodgrass. The fans are unhappy, and as I said, justifiably so. The dressing room is unhappy. They've got picked 7 points from 18 games, is it, since the winning those first 2 matches of the season. It's a big job, but if he gets them out of it, I'm sure the next step will be a bigger, better, more stable Premier League club than Hull.
Time for quick hits. The clues in the name. We want very quick answers. When Gab's in the chair, he uses gadgetry to let the panellists know it's time to stop. I'm not going to do that. I'm not a bully. I'm just going to cough when you've gone on too long. So keep them brief, guys. Wayne Rooney has now scored 249 goals in 543 games for United, bringing him level with Sir Bobby Charlton's record. James, how impressed are you and how long has he got left at Old Trafford?
Extremely impressed. I think to become England's leading goal scorer and Manchester United's leading goal scorer, which he will do very, very soon, has to be one of the great football achievements. It has to be. You know, if you look at him, he hasn't got forever left at Old Trafford. You know, he's slowly being phased out, which I think people can see, but it's a phenomenal achievement.
Brighton are through to the fourth round of the FA Cup and they lead the Championship. It's time we saw Chris Hughton's side in the Premier League, isn't it, Ollie?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, they've been building slowly. They've come close a few times over recent season. They're a good team, 18 matches unbeaten in the Championship. Chris Hughton knows what he's doing. They've invested soundly, got good young players, good experienced players. And, yes, I think they'll come up and it will be very welcome when they do.
And they were one of those teams who made wholesale changes and still won their cup tie.
Mm.
Pep Guardiola goes all humble after being sniffy about criticism of his team and his methods. Julien, was the 5-0 thrashing of West Ham in the Cup a turning point for the perfectionist?
I think nothing is ever good enough for Pep, and certainly Friday wouldn't be or wouldn't have been good enough. But it was better, I thought. The Nordvik own goal was such an incredible move, I thought, both, you know, on the ball, off the ball from City. That's what they can do, and that's what they will do more and more. And I think we see a much better City team in the second part of the season. But surely Pep will have something to say about even a 5-0 win. Mm-hmm.
Antonio Conte was given grief via the phone-ins for the defeat to Spurs that ended the endless winning streak. They won in the Cup, though, so crisis averted, James?
Very, very harsh, isn't it, to say they're in crisis? I think he's a victim.
I was being sarcastic.
Were you? It's very harsh being sarcastic. I think I think he's been a victim of his own success, and it's such a great run. To be fair, they didn't turn up against Spurs. You know, Tottenham were thoroughly deserved their... thing. Everything's great for them, really, isn't it? Top of the league in the next round of the Cup.
Still with Chelsea, Ollie. Nathan Aki has been recalled from his loan spell with Bournemouth, but... will he start for Conte? And if so, who will miss out?
He will start some matches. He'll be cover for one thing. I mean, particularly for Gary Cahill on the left-hand side of that back three, I would think. I think that's the obvious position for him to cover. And look at Chelsea so far. They've had no real injuries at the back. Cahill, Luiz and Aspinacueta have played together throughout that run, pretty much. For the moment, Luiz arrived at the end of August, and they just need more depth to their squad, I think, because you know, it's not one of those seasons where they've got a terribly strong bench. You know, they've got some players, but perhaps not enough depth to withstand an injury crisis. And another thing I would say is, okay, really good player, and Bournemouth will miss him.
Jose Mourinho supports the FIFA proposal to expand the World Cup to, wait for it, 48, yes, 48 countries. But does Julien Laurent?
I don't think it's a very good idea at all. And when you look at it, they won 16 groups of three countries in a World Cup, which I don't even know what letter that would be. Like, would you play in Group R or something like that? It's just ridiculous. I don't think it would work. Maybe go up to 36, 40 maybe, but not, you surely can't go above 40 teams. It would be stupid.
My God, I haven't had to cough once. This is incredible.
Alison, I've got one for you as you're in the hot seat today. So you get the special one. You went to Nonlink Sutton on Saturday. Why did you go there?
Well, because I didn't want to go to PSG or anywhere like that. So I went in search. I went in search of the real romance of the FA Cup, and I did find it. It was 0-0 Sutton v AFC Wimbledon, but there were so many subplots to this match, not least the fact Wimbledon are just down the road from Sutton, and I don't think I have ever been or will ever go again to a derby. It's a true derby, they're separated by a couple of miles, that was as friendly as that. And it was a club, Sutton are a club just run by volunteers. A manager pays to manage them. He paid for the pitch. And the vibe is just
played at Gardner Green Lane, is it?
Gander Green Lane.
Gander Green Lane.
And On the 3G pitch?
No, before it was 3G.
Okay. Well, now they've got a 3G pitch, which means they're sort of stuck in this twilight zone of football because they can't get promoted to the league because they'd have to dig up the pitch. And no, they can't dig up the pitch because the pitch pays for everything.
Yeah, but to be fair, they've done well because when I played, it was in Step 3, Ryman Premier League, and they've now gone up two divisions.
But they can't go any further.
No, but to go further is a big, big, big...
Yes,
big it, it's a massive jump. You know, you're going into football league then, and so I think they're a long, long way off that, but they're a good club.
But it was a beautiful occasion and...
good game?
It was nil-nil, and yet it really was a good game. There was some nice, thoughtful football.
That Rory Deacon looks a decent player.
They have a lot. They have a lot. Yeah. They have a lot. And but they're there. They get good players in because they tell them, we'll just make you a little bit better and then we'll let you go whenever you want to go. And we'll advertise you if necessary. So it's a good stepping stone for young players. Thank you, everybody. God, that sounded very polite and schoolmarmy, didn't it? Oh, jeez. Somebody did actually write in and say, I sound like a headmistress. I must stop that. So that's all, folks. Many thanks to my guests today, Julien Neron, Ollie Kay and James Scowcroft. Remember, just search The Times online for a £12 12-week trial for all the wonderful Times content. And please post a review on iTunes if you're listening to us on an Apple device, and do tell Gab how much you missed it.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
This is the summer to expand your horizons. You've had enough staying home. You've had enough confinement. It's time to explore. But before you set foot out the door, set foot in the ultimate travel shoes from Allbirds. Like the breathable, silky smooth tree runner, the responsive foam and extra grip of the tree dasher, or the classic low-top look of the tree piper. Allbirds has a shoe ready for whatever adventures you have planned. Whether you're traveling to the ends of the earth or settling in for a staycation, you need a shoe that's versatile enough to go with any outfit, durable enough to wear over any terrain, and lightweight enough to make packing a breeze. Being made from insanely comfortable, breezy eucalyptus fiber is a plus, too. When you wear Allbirds travel shoes, you're in vacation mode before you even leave the house. They're the only shoes your suitcase needs. Boarding pass? Check. Passport? Check. The perfect travel shoe? Check. Find your perfect pair of tree dashers, runners, pipers, and more at Allbirds.com. That's Allbirds.com.